Tension.
So, tonight's topic is techniques or tools that we might use to when we find ourselves in situations of anxiety or sadness, depression. So what I thought we'd do is start with a few minutes of a kind of meta-meditation, which we'll call tool number one. And then we'll share some ideas on additional tools. We've been compiling a little list, and go into a few discussion topics after we give our little talk here. I have some amount of experience with depression, so I guess that's the side that I'll call my specialty. I've always been reluctant to label it depression, though. I've always just called it my moods. So when I read accounts of people that are really severely depressed and what's like life is like for them, I know that there are these vast hells that I've got no idea, I've never glimpsed of. I don't have as much experience with anxiety, so may have a little bit of less of a weight to that. And that may be part of what we discuss then afterwards is, are the tools that we've talked about equally applicable, or are there places where one is better for something than another? Anyway, let's start with this just a little brief period of metta or loving kindness meditation. So I'll just guide us through that.
You should put that in your tool belt.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll start again with watching our breath, letting ourselves become calm and relaxed. Let your mind become clean and free from impurities, free from lust and hatred and ignorance, free from all evil thoughts. And fill your heart and your mind with peaceful and sublime thoughts of boundless love, overflowing compassion, sympathetic joy, and perfect equanimity. I release from my mind and heart all anger, ill will, cruelty, violence, jealousy, envy, passion, and aversion. May I be well and happy. Now think of a child, or maybe a pet, innocent and vulnerable, who needs kindness and care. Maybe your child at a younger age, a grandchild, or you might recall a photograph of yourself at a young age. Bring this image into your mind and heart. Let yourself feel tenderness and compassion for this innocent being. And watch and let that feeling of tenderness grow in you for a few moments. And you right now are also innocent and vulnerable like that. And you deserve that care and compassion equally. May I be well and happy. May I be free from suffering, unease, grief, worry, and anger. May I be strong, self-confident, healthy, and peaceful. May I see humor and lightness in everyday situations. was generally in metta-meditation, we then expand these feelings we've cultivated, extending our kindness out in expanding circles to near and loved ones, to family and friends, and then out to beings everywhere. What I have gained, I now give to others. May all beings be well and happy. Think that all are your brothers and sisters, fellow beings in the ocean of life. Identify yourself with all of them. For this meditation, let's end by coming back to that image of ourselves, innocent, vulnerable, needing and deserving compassion. May I be well and happy. So again, the topic being a toolkit for anxiety and sadness, and we're kind of suggesting that this loving kindness meditation is tool number one. It's a good general purpose tool, like a pair of pliers or something. It fits a lot of situations, useful. So first we give ourselves metta or loving kindness like we just did, and then we extend it to others. And in doing that, we use it to recognize our connection with other people. I think a lot of the time we skip over ourselves kind of quickly. I know I do whenever we do meditations. It seems like the point is to get that loving kindness out to other people, and sometimes there's even a question of whether I really deserve the metta. It's, you know, I may as well just give it out to the people that do deserve it. And so it's important part of it to bring it to yourself first. Do you have any?
As far as metta goes, I think some of us, maybe, I guess I would count myself amongst this too, have had a slight aversion to it. I don't know, like saying phrases and things, but at some times in some places it can be really helpful. And I think for me, to creating my own phrases that fit what I really kind of need for myself really helps. And it's been recommended, I think, to just, limit it to 3 or 5 that you can remember and that are pretty significant. And this is maybe something that you can talk to each other about too in your small groups. If you've done that, how has it worked for you? And that kind of thing too when you get to it. You know, I don't think we introduced ourselves either, Steve.
Oh.
Yeah. This is Steve.
I'm Steve Hansen.
And I'm Mary Haberman. Yeah. Haberman, yeah. And I do have a confession to make. Did you hear someone snoring during meditation? It was me, right? Let's just get that out there. I have been sleep deprived, and I woke myself up snoring during meditation. So hopefully it wasn't too disturbing for too many people, but you're all feeling very much meta right now. So.
I thought she had some new technique she was doing.
Yeah, that's what it was.
It sounded kind of Tibetan. All right, back to depression. Okay, the next thing I had was a kind of a description of depression from somebody named Andrew Solomon in in Anatomy of Melancholy. He said, when you're depressed, the past and the future are absorbed entirely by the present. As in the world of a three-year-old, you can neither remember feeling better nor imagine that you will feel better. Being upset, even profoundly upset, is a temporal experience, whereas depression is atemporal. Depression means that you have no point of view. And then for anxiety, we've got a description from a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, Maurice Schweitzer. He says, anxiety increases the cognitive load, so you may be unable to think about much else besides what's making you anxious. So in those descriptions, there's kind of a place to see where the ability to break through with some kind of self-love, self-meta, would be very helpful. It's also kind of interesting, though, that like Solomon describes being absorbed entirely by the present as part of a problem. And we spend a lot of time in meditation trying to get ourselves back to the present. And so that's actually something that there's a good discussion on where that is, what's good and bad in that. And that I think we might hear about it next week when we hear something about the self. I don't think so. John's going to be presenting on that. And as for connection, there's a story, pretty well-known story, about a grieving mother who repeatedly begged the Buddha to bring her child back to life. And he finally said that she would have to bring him a single mustard seed from a house that had not experienced grief. And so she went from house to house in the village trying to find such a mustard seed. And each house, she sat and listened, heard the stories of the loss that had been experienced in that house. And in every one, there was great grief and sadness. And in the end, it didn't diminish her sadness any, and it didn't bring back her child because she was never able to find such a mustard seed. But it probably did a lot for her compassion and her feeling of connection with other people, to be able to see that sadness is universal. And then another tool is doing what we did tonight, which is coming together and meditating in a group and being part of a community, part of a sangha. And again, you probably couldn't find a mustard seed in this room either if you started looking. There's also a story that we use quite often from the suttas with this metaphor of multiple arrows, where the pain you feel, whether it's physical or emotional, is the first arrow. And then as you start layering on suffering, it's like you're stabbing yourself with additional arrows as you're telling stories and reliving and just adding to the experience. There's the initial pain, and then we add additional suffering on top of it. And I think that sadness is a place where we probably do that as much as any other situation where we feel low. Maybe it's, you know, it could be through brain chemistry or through hearing hearing news or injury or loss. And then the guilt, the reliving the event, the imagining, the stories, the unworthiness, and then we can create this growing monster that we construct of a bleak and meaningless existence with no future. And those are just more and more arrows we're stabbing ourselves with. So if in the midst of that construction of the mood, we can notice that we're stabbing ourselves, and just note it in a way that we note thoughts in meditation, we can start to break some of that momentum. And I know I really catch myself building a mood that way. And sometimes I'm able to just stop and say, really? Or is this, what are you doing here? And it kind of shines a light on the fabricating that I'm doing. So then the Buddha's got these the right effort, part of the Eightfold Path, has four great efforts that make it up. And the first one is avoiding the arising of unwholesome behavior or situation. The second is dispelling harmful behavior that has already arisen. Third is develop beneficial behavior. And the fourth is to nurture and cultivate behavior that we already have. So for this first two, I think of smoking as an example of those. If you don't smoke, don't start. And the second one, if you do smoke, stop. And then for three and four, you can think of exercising. If you don't exercise, start. If you do exercise, keep it up. And so when we're talking about this idea of stopping these multiple arrows, then that's part of that the second one. If you smoke, stop. If you're stabbing yourself with arrows, stop. So we're in a situation where there's sadness or anxiety that's arisen, and we want to dispel the multiple arrows that we're sticking ourselves with. But it's not always easy. There's a lot of times that no matter how much it hurts, it seems that there's almost an attractiveness to wallowing in those old familiar emotions for a while. I watched myself do that a lot of times. As a mood's coming on, and I just kind of see it. I know it's happening, but it's like standing at a counter of the store when you promised you'd quit smoking that morning, and you know it's the wrong thing to do, but you hear yourself saying, "Give me a pack of Marlboro." So there's some techniques that Ajahn Jeff gave to us when he was here for a weekend recently. And I need to acknowledge John Fries for assembling these items for us in a talk he put together for the teaching corps last year.
So yeah, the sheet that I just handed out is kind of going through some of the things we already talked about. It's kind of in the middle right now about some of the tools. You know, you can see where it says use the tools of right effort that Steve just talked about. And then we're kind of in the next sections there.
Yeah. So the first of these is the different object. So you've got an anxious or depressed thought that's going on, and you replace it with a different object. And John suggests that with restlessness and anxiety, we might change to a simple object that leads to calm, especially watching the breath or something like that, that will calm us down. And for depression, it could be finding some image, like in the meditation, the image of the child or something that will bring a sense of joy to your heart. So you try to move from the sad image to something with joy in it. And the next one in the list is to look at the disadvantages of what you're doing. And so you reflect on the undesirable consequences of building this, doing this multiple stabbing. You know, it's not good for you. And I guess this one seems difficult to me, and it might be something that again, you could explore in the discussion, is it seems that a lot of these states aren't really susceptible to a reasoned argument like this. We're kind of caught in something that's beyond reason. But, you know, so the question is, where is this helpful? And again, it's a tool that you might find some places where you can convince yourself that the disadvantages are bad and use reason to come out of it.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that it seems a little bit like, you know, it could create another arrow. Like, I already know this is bad for me, but I'm doing it anyway. And, you know, racking up the disadvantages, I guess, might not be helpful. But to me, one way to think about it is to maybe remember an experience. Like, some of the sub-bullets here are, you know, remembering that humans are poor predictors of how we will feel. I think that came from the Daniel Gilbert thing. So maybe you can remember some time where you expected to feel one way and then you felt something different, you know, that you might not feel this way forever, kind of getting out of that, just being stuck in the present. Or remember a time that you were really resilient and sort of maybe an experience like that could remind you of how these, you know, feelings aren't necessarily true, I guess, and aren't necessarily helpful. That's what I had to add there. I mean, I guess another one that is up further is to remember, I don't know where it is now on the list, kind of threw some things together here, but just to remember that things change too, I think. And for me, I guess, how to remember that things change is to remember something in the past that changed, you know, like, oh yeah, I felt really anxious about such and such, but it turned out okay. Or I had a dark time that year, this, you know, in the past, and then after that was some really good times. And, you know, or I think if you realize that even just during the day, if you're present, you can see at a time you might feel kind of bad, and then you're like, yeah, but half an hour ago, I was really happy because, you know, I got this free sweatshirt or something like that, you know? But so when you get the free sweatshirt, you know, you might be like, this is cool, which is another thing that I put on the list too, is just really realizing when you are having something good happen to you or experiencing happiness.
Yeah, the next one on the list is non-attention and non-reflection, which is the idea is to redirect your attention to something else. So this is another slightly subtle one because it almost sounds like you're avoiding and ignoring the problem. But I know Ajahn Jeff went through this one and talked about places where it's skillful to do this, and it's kind of, if you're stuck and you don't have any other way of dealing with something that's overwhelming, then sometimes it is appropriate to push it aside and redirect your attention to something else.
Yeah, and this seems to me pretty common sense too. Like, just when if you're feeling kind of mopey or whatever, to go on a run or do something different. Or I have, I guess, sometimes described just having this kind of mood. Sometimes on a Sunday, it's, where you're just sort of vaguely dissatisfied. You know, can't really think of anything that's going to feel that great. And sometimes when I'm in that mood, actually, you know, might get some tools out and do a project or something. It's like, I haven't done that in a long time because I'm not a homeowner now. But, you know, like accomplish something, do some work, change, get a change of scenery or whatever. So, I mean, it seems wholesome and common sense.
And John's notes also had the note that the commentaries on the Buddha's teachings suggest additional ways to redirect the mind, reading the Dharma, reciting a sutta aloud, saying out loud, or mentally noting the names of objects in view, or simply doing some skillful physical activity, like Mary talked about, some exercise or something. Then the next one is searching the cause, or examining where this is coming from, and kind of looking. So this is kind of, in a way, the opposite of non-attention. Of instead of looking somewhere else, you look at this very carefully. So you would confront the anxiety directly as an object of meditation, scrutinize its features, investigate its cause, and then use that felt sense, that body sensation, the sense doors that we were working on last week. So you really feel that. Where is that in the body? Where is that in my mind? And then you turn and face that head on and really examine it carefully. So again, it's between this one and the previous one, it's, you know, if it's too strong and you can't stand to face it directly, then you find something else to do. If you're able to, then you go into it.
But somehow in the facing it directly, you get out of your own self-experience of it too, and get a little bit removed. So in some ways it's kind of similar result, I guess. You're getting out of the loop.
And the last one here is restraining, where you vigorously suppress the thought with your will. And I think Caroline had some good language for what that. Do you remember what the some sort of
wrestler?
Yeah, or some kind of stomping or something like that.
I think Ajahn Jeff said, "Jam the circuits."
Sounds good.
I think somewhere in the suttas it says, "Press your tongue to the top of your mouth as hard as you can."
And I put on that one too in parentheses, maybe, you know, how about a gentler approach to a little sarcasm with yourself, where you can laugh at yourself, you know. But, just feeling sorry for myself and. You know, I don't know, taking it as far as you can, that, you know, I'm the saddest person that's ever been on the planet, and no one's ever had a worse experience than me, kind of thing. Kind of humor.
I think that that's kind of the list of what we've got so far. I don't know if you had anything else.
Well, there's more on the list on the bottom that I added. I happened to see this article that was in the newspaper in the employment section on anxiety. It was kind of interesting. They were saying that when you're anxious, it's a bad time to take advice, but we seek advice because we don't really know what to do. And so we ask other people for advice, and then we don't have very good discernment about that advice. So that's something to keep in mind, I guess. And I was thinking for myself, you know, I think that's kind of true. If I'm feeling a little bit lost, I'm more likely to check my horoscope, you know? Maybe it'll tell me what I should do, as opposed to other times when I'm feeling like I know what I'm doing, I'm like, oh, you know, that stuff doesn't mean anything. So, yeah, I don't know. That kind of resonated with me in that way. And I think another thing about going to back to the top of the list, just acknowledging your feelings. One of the things that this same psychologist said about anxiety was that anger might, you might get a stand and fight response, but with anxiety you get a flight response. And then sometimes you just don't want to deal. And so, you know, sweep it under the rug, don't do anything about it. I mean, I see this with high school and college students who haven't turned anything in a long time. They stop coming to class, or they just won't, you know, they'll avoid you because it's gotten so bad that they just can't deal. Mm-hmm. So
deer in the headlight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just because we are supposed to accept things as they are, maybe as meditators or Buddhists, doesn't mean that you can't deal. You know, you gotta, if you can deal, and then your chances are that whatever you're anxious about will get dealt with. So, you know, if you can take action to improve the situation, first acknowledge your feelings. I am feeling anxious. Why am I feeling anxious? And then, can I do anything about it? What can I do? And get up the gumption to do it, I guess. I mean, I think about somebody's story somewhere along the line that, you know, if you get a flat tire in your car, you don't just, you know, sit and meditate and, you know, think, you know, well, I have to accept the fact that I got a flat tire. But no, you know, you can change it. You can take some action, but you can also, you know, maybe not be so annoyed while you're dealing with whatever you have to deal with, hopefully, if you have more peace of mind and more presence. And I think, too, I was thinking about this, like the fifth or so bullet down, you know, remember that you're not alone. And Steve mentioned the story about the woman going around to find out who else had suffered. I mean, to me, that helps a lot. You know, you think sometimes that everyone else has got it together and you don't. And then when you hear that somebody else is struggling, you're kind of like, oh, that's a cool person too, and they're struggling too, so maybe I'm not in this alone. And sometimes, I mean, maybe this isn't very Buddhist, I kind of feel like I'm sort of being like Sylvia Boorstein with some of my examples, which, you know, I don't know if that's good or not. But, you know, sometimes if I, you know, feel like I want to feel a connection with humankind, I might pick a good movie that makes me feel sort of like, you know, I can relate to this story, or a book or something like that. Maybe, you know, maybe you can't connect with other people, but you can connect with humanity through some other art form. And I don't know if it's okay to recommend movies, probably wholesome movies. Right? There are some, yeah. And then kind of going back down, another thing that came up in that article I read about anxiety was that self-confidence is an inoculation, he used that word, against anxiety. So, you know, just remembering what makes you feel confident and makes you feel you, and doing that can help you deal with whatever you have to do. And of course, this is probably when you're dealing with depression and anxiety, not the time when you feel very self-confident. But if you kind of know, these handful of things usually make me feel better, you know, kind of have your short list to go to. And this, I think, is really useful. Ask yourself what's the worst that could happen and play it out, and then it might not be so scary, because a lot of anxiety is about the uncertainty. And I think about this, I was driving down to Seattle on the day that it was snowing before, a few days before Christmas, the 19th, I think, and I was supposed to catch a plane, and I was in traffic north of Everett about an hour before my plane was supposed to go, and I was like, I don't think I'm going to make it, you know? And so I was like, okay, let's just say I missed the plane. What's the worst that could happen? And I was like, well, actually, really crappy flight, so maybe I'll get a more direct flight. Maybe it'll be better. Maybe you won't have to stop in Vegas and then Denver and then Omaha. So then I was like, well, that wouldn't be too bad, you know? So then I was kind of curious about whether I was going to make it or not instead of all stressed out. I did make it, barely. And then I had to spend the night in Denver, so I'm not sure it was good because of snow. Or try to replace anxiety with excitement. Try to visualize the best case scenario. That I think of like, I'm going to go with a sports metaphor here. You know, let's say that you have the last second shot, you know, but if you're anxious about it and you're like, I don't want to have all the pressure of the last second shot, then, you know, that's one attitude. I might choke. The other attitude might be like, hey, I could have the last second basket and win the game. And if you didn't, at least you tried, as opposed to trying but worrying about it. And your chances are better, I think, if you look at it as excitement anyway, too. I've been helping out with the basketball team coaching a little bit, and I think the attitude at the free throw line, instead of, man, we're missing all of our free throws, you got to make it, you know, I've been saying to the girls at the free throw line, you know, just watch it going in, and you got this, you know, so that they have a better attitude. It seems to actually help. I think our free throw percentage has gone up a little bit. And then, you know, be curious about what will happen. Take yourself out as a key figure in the events. I mean, I'm gonna use a Star Wars reference here. There was one scene in one of the early Star Wars, I'm not that big of a Star Wars fan, so I don't remember, but Liam Neeson was, you know, the Jedi Knight, and they were getting chased by somebody, and then they went into an asteroid field, and so, you know, their chances of survival were really low. And his response was, this should be interesting. And I thought, that's very Buddhist, you know? And he kind of didn't, you know, wasn't so stressed out or worried about his role, but just kind of curious to see, how am I going to get out of this, or how are we going to get out of this? A gratefulness practice, that's good, I think. Cultivating humor, noticing it, relishing it, looking for it. Abraham Lincoln's suffered a lot of depression. Actually, there's a pretty good book about Abraham Lincoln's depression called Lincoln's Melancholy, I think. I mean, and he really had to, like, he had a toolkit, too, that he developed himself to deal with it. Also interesting in that book is how the cultural attitude was different, and depression was kind of seen as, you know, that you had sort of a intuitive, emotional, artistic ability. It wasn't so vilified as it is a lot of times in our modern world, and that you could still be president even if you were on suicide watch at 30 with your friends. You know? That would be, you know, possible. And he was, you know, his friends were worried that he was going to kill himself when he was in his 30s. Music, and you got to, I don't know, for me, pick the kind of music you listen to, you know, not the sad stuff, which is most music, really. If you really try to pick uplifting, good songs, they're harder to find. Hugs, I put that in there. Yeah. And then Philip Moffitt's book had a whole thing on, you know, his book was mainly that we read last year, Dancing with Life, about really recognizing dukkha and so suffering and where and when and the parameters of it. But the last chapter was about also recognizing sukha or happiness, and if you're more looking for it and recognizing it, then realizing that it's there. And even when you're maybe in a depressed frame of mind or anxious about something, that it's not a constant, that there are moments when things are different and you are happy. It's kind of another metaphor I think of for long distance hikers is the uphill is not all up and the downhill is not all down. So if you have 5 miles of up, it's really maybe 4.5. There's a few downhills here and there. And then cultivating conditions for it too. So, oh, and another thing, this little quote came in my email, which somehow I got in this runner's magazine, like quotes, and they're usually inspirational, and I actually kind of like it, you know? So, and Philip Moffitt was doing that too. Just, I think for me, it's like just reminders of things, and the more that you can get in practice of reminding yourself these things, because we know a lot of these things, we just forget them in our own contracted mind, maybe. This one was interesting. A young woman said, truly, I love running. It's who I am. It's part of me. Even if I can only run for 10 minutes, I feel whole and happy. And if everything else is falling to pieces, I go for a run. And I feel like things are going to be okay. And she not very well known, I guess, Johanna Olsen, was an Olympic marathon trials runner, but she died at age 33 of brain cancer. So she had some things to deal with, obviously. And that's the list, so just kind of a hodgepodge of, you know, things that maybe are useful. So we can discuss a little bit.
Yeah.
So the way that we were doing the discussions, does anybody have any questions or anything? John?
I want to know why Steve isn't at least telling one joke.
Oh, okay.
Well, you know, I was looking around for depression jokes and
depressing.
Here's one. What's good about being depressed? Nothing, but it's no worse than anything else since all of life sucks anyway.
There you go.
Then there's this Woody Allen one. More than any other time in history, mankind faces a crossroads. Our path leads to despair and utter hopelessness, one path. The other path to total extinction. Let us pray we have the wisdom to choose correctly.